Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. In today's episode, we go live to Ishta Yoga, where I interview Mona Anand. Mona's a fellow Yogi Raj in the Ishta lineage and the co-owner of Ishta Yoga. She's a senior trainer with me in Ishta teacher trainings. Mona devotes a significant portion of her time to yoga nidra and restorative yoga. She's the co-founder of Mona Anand's Ishta Yoga Nidra, a 9-step system of yoga nidra that she developed with Alan Finger. She also developed a restorative yoga training with Gina Menza that incorporates visualization, pranayama, kriya, and Ayurveda. Hope you enjoy it. Let's go. Hi, Mona.
Hello. Hi, Peter.
How's it going?
Good.
It seems like we're alone in people's ears, but really there are a whole bunch of people in this room.
Yes.
We're live at Ishta Yoga. Yeah. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Excellent. Hi, Anais. Excellent. So I've invited you here to talk about yoga. Yeah, real yoga, actual happiness, deep living. And you and I have been studying yoga together for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah, we were in the same teacher training.
200 and 300.
Yeah. Yes. Back in 2002, 2003.
Mm-hmm. Got married during our training.
I got married.
Yes.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you already married then? No.
Yes, I've been married very long.
Okay.
25 years.
Wow.
This year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. You have to share the secrets on in some other format, perhaps.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So as someone who's been practicing yoga for a long time, mm-hmm. when you get asked the inevitable questions about yoga, like what do you do? And then you say, I teach yoga, and people go, oh, I can't do that. I can't touch my toes, or whatever other things, you know, people generally say, how do you respond to them? What do you say yoga is?
I usually say, the first thing they always say is yoga is I'm not flexible enough. That's mm-hmm. the standard line. I always say it's not about flexibility, you know. It's really about being able to move through life with a little bit more ease. And, you know, that if you come into practice, you'll find that nothing changes externally, but you'll feel totally different about life. And then that allows you to enjoy life more.
And do people buy that?
No.
No.
They tell me, no. You know, that's very nice, but you don't realize how inflexible
that's right.
I am.
Yeah.
So I just always say, just come in, it just helps you to relax. I think you have to meet people where they are, you know,
right.
just sort of say that with their idea of yoga, it'll help you feel more relaxed, less stressed.
And yeah.
For everyone, it's a different door that they come into yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I think we're in a karmic moment, too, where many, many people are trying. They're intrigued.
Yeah.
Or their friend is doing it and they see something changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the most powerful draw, is when you can actually see someone you're close to change.
Right.
You know, just see much more relaxed about life and happier.
Yeah, it's sort of the basis of community building, right?
Yeah.
Somebody you appreciate is doing something, and so you do that thing, too. Yeah, great. And you've been here trying to build a little bit of community as well.
Yeah.
We have a community, but doing some explicit things, and that's really sweet.
Yeah, I think it's just such an important part of the practice. I think sometimes when we get
eating and drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always important.
Yeah, that's what Al says.
But I think like sometimes we get into yoga and we get it just becomes a path that you're on, your own path. And it can almost make people a little self-obsessed.
Right, right.
And, you know, that's the idea is to be able to connect to each other. So it's easy to get on your own path and all about your own sensations, you know.
Yeah. So. Some of each, though, too, because some people are so devoted to taking care of other people that they don't take care of themselves.
Totally. So it's a balance, right?
And so yoga's, in a way, an interesting thing. It's not a team sport. It's not a thing you might do in an office. It's really you on the mat, even though other people are around you.
Yeah, I mean, you can't connect to anyone if you can't connect to yourself.
Yeah.
So it's this interesting dynamic, right?
Yeah.
That the more you feel yourself, the more you feel everyone else.
Yeah, I think so. And I want to talk about this, and we don't have to talk, launch into it right away, but I'm interested in sort of the range of yoga practices that are in the toolbox, right? So we both teach asana practice. Mm-hmm. We both teach meditation. You teach a lot of yoga nidra.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of your master specialty. And when you're looking at someone new, like someone comes off the street and they come to practice yoga, where do you usually start with them? Like if you were, I don't know, do you work privately very much? Or
I
not?
Used to a lot, but
yeah,
not so much.
Not so much
lately,
anymore.
Yeah.
So when someone comes to you and they say, well, okay, I'm interested, what should I do? How would you approach that?
I think a lot
of teachers listening. And
yeah,
so.
I think people, when they first start practicing, you can really feel the gross movements of the body. That's where you can most easily connect. So I think asana is kind of easiest for people just moving to the breath. I think yoga nidra is great for anyone. You know, it's like one of those things that people give their grandmother, they give their child. Everyone can practice yoga nidra. So I think in terms of meditation, I think yoga nidra is a much easier meditation than a seated meditation for someone new. And I also give people a lot of restorative. Because I just feel that people don't realize how much stress they're carrying in their bodies.
Yeah.
And it's when your body is completely supported for a while that you suddenly have that let go.
Yeah.
So I kind of mix it up with asana, definitely restorative, and then into yoga nidra.
Mm-hmm.
Just
we're,
the yoga nidra will change.
We're very complimentary in that way because I always injure myself doing restorative yoga. I don't know why.
Because you haven't...
And then, I'm serious, I always do.
Well,
and
you haven't come to the right teachers.
I haven't come to the right class. And then in yoga nidra, I always fall asleep.
But that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I in fact use it to fall asleep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. Depends what the intention is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
So
I never hear all of the magnificent things that you're spinning in
but
your
yoga
nidra.
But it's going into your subconscious.
Ah.
Yeah.
Is that why I'm acting the way I am?
Yeah. Yeah, it goes into your subconscious.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So for people who've never heard of yoga nidra before, could you just give a brief summary of what it is?
Okay, so it's bringing yourself into the place between being awake and being asleep.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the hypnagogic state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a state where your body and mind are able to relax much more than even when you're in deep sleep. And it's a place you can use it for many things. You can use it just to relax. Use it to fall asleep. It's a great place, that state between two states, to release what's in the subconscious and the unconscious. And it's also a great place to create an expanded state of mind. So people can go on these journeys and have these great visualizations that you're missing.
Yes.
Yes. That
a guided meditation.
A guided meditation. But you can get out of your, that's not possible. Because you're in the state where your mind sort of lies down and you can see things.
Like in a dream.
Yeah, like a child, right? Mm-hmm. Children are not, can see whatever you say. They can visualize, right?
Mm-hmm.
As once we become adults, we're saying, that's not possible,
mm-hmm.
right? So they can have that child's mind again.
Nice.
So that's really what I think it's so useful for, you know?
And then you tailor the way that you speak in the that part.
Yeah.
To give people different effects. Create different effects or to create different leanings in how their mind might go based on what they are working with or working on.
Absolutely. So I might have, it's totally different if you're using it to go to sleep. It's very different if you're using it to balance a particular chakra or you're using it to sort of probe into like second chakra stuff or, yeah, all the nine steps of yoga nidra will be changed based on.
There are nine steps?
There are nine steps.
Oh, my
steps.
Gosh, and I fall asleep in the first one. Sometimes I make it to counting backwards.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. That's what, number two?
No, asana is number one.
Oh, okay.
With nyasa.
Okay.
So that's, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. You make it to step four.
Oh, thank you. Right? I feel much more accomplished now.
So the asana, there's always asana with yoga nidra, for me, because I feel like you have to kind of direct the energy into that place.
Mm-hmm.
If you just, it's sort of like with meditation, if you just tell someone to come sit, that's extremely difficult to do.
That's what I do.
Yeah. No, don't you make them do a little cat-cow?
I do. I make them do asana and breathing and visualization or kriya.
So it's kind of like taking the weeds out to prepare.
Yeah. And I know that many, many people really love the yoga nidra practice because your classes are full of people who are loving that. And you've been doing it. Your high school class was enjoying it, right?
Yeah. I started doing it in high school, and it was just amazing because I was actually a really competitive athlete and just pushing. And we had this teacher who'd come into school, and we just lie down on the floor, the whole school.
That's
and
great.
She would lead us through this yoga nidra.
Right.
And she'd say 20 minutes was like 6 hours of sleep.
Uh-huh.
So this really appealed to my type A personality then. I was like, okay, now I can cut down on some sleep.
There are other high school students who wouldn't want that at all. They like that 24 hours of sleep,
But it would take me to this amazing place of stillness, which I just had never experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I just used it from then on in college and graduate school. It was something if someone couldn't sleep, had to study, I'd say, okay, if you're up all night, just let me know, I'll do this technique and you'll feel fresh.
That's great.
So I used it a lot before I ever thought.
Pusher.
Yeah. In fact, my roommate from college was down and I said, do you remember what I used to do to you? She said, what is this yoga nidra? And I said, that thing I used to do when you had been up all night.
Oh, that's great.
But it's just been such a powerful force, And I remember when I first started taking classes in America, I couldn't believe there was no yoga nidra at the end, right? I would lie down and nothing would happen. And Because I kind of feel, and I always say this, that, each culture has its own imbalances. And we put so much in the West into teaching doing, like Warrior Two, but we don't put that same effort into teaching to surrender and deeply relax, right? Because we're much more of a doing than being culture.
Wait, which
culture.
We are you speaking about?
American we.
I'm
half and half,
so I
can speak we on each side.
I just want to make sure you're not dissing my teaching here.
Oh, no. We as in America.
Outside of Ishta Yoga.
We as in Western. Just saying that Western concept is much more of the importance of doing, right?
Yeah.
That's what makes us different at Ishta, right? Because we have meditation and restorative and yoga nidra is the focus, right? Definitely meditation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of it as like the full spectrum of yoga.
Yeah.
What yoga is for.
Yeah.
You can't get there just by doing one part.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think we sometimes do that too much. We compartmentalize. Right? This is asana.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's restorative. And, now it's, instead of it being a blend of everything.
Right. And I don't know about what happens in your classes, but there are times when I'm intending to do something, but people look just fine as they are. And so I don't necessarily do something, right? I don't necessarily do more asana, or I don't necessarily do a meditation. That they seem cooked, as Mark Whitwell used to say.
And
that's enough. They're done. So you can be a bit free with the sequencing as you're paying attention to the result of what you've done so far and maybe where they came in that day.
Yeah.
I was telling this funny story that Lindsay Sandwald was helping me out, assisting in meditation class, and I was running late on my train, and I called her and I said, just do the premeditative asana. But she started by having them do alternate nostril breathing and they just all went into meditation. So I showed up and I was like, what's up here? They're all in meditation already. you know.
So then you just hung out.
We're done.
Yeah,
just, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So there was not much of a class that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, a very special class.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, about 30 minutes in, I was like, well, I guess I should do something else with them.
Yeah.
Because normally I talk for half an hour. And then...
That must have been funny. Yeah.
Yeah,
so. Yeah. Yeah.
Lindsay was...
You're more less planned than me. I really plan.
Yes.
Yeah. But I never have ever stuck to my plan.
To the plan.
Yeah. So it's, yeah.
There you
the
go.
The plan is there.
Yes.
But it's really
It's in your
followed.
Subconscious, just like what you say to me in yoga nidra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I'm teaching your class.
Maybe.
You put it in my
yeah,
subconscious.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah.
You know, I read this thing, and actually it's in the Bihar Yoga Nidra book, and it talks about how there's this boy, and he's only listens to... They only put on French tapes when he's sleeping, just when he's falling asleep. So he's never heard French awake, but he then knows French because your subconscious can pick up things. It cannot resist anything. So that's a very powerful state when someone's just falling asleep in what information you're giving them.
Right.
So we are actually receiving that information.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's actually, I always say it's changed my behavior when my children are falling asleep. More careful not to get into some kind of argument with my spouse or something, because it's all absorbed, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You will behave tomorrow.
I've thought of that. With my teenager. Well, now she's 20. You love me.
Right.
Very much.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to try that tonight.
Try it to Wendy.
Yeah.
See what happens when she wakes up.
I am right sometimes.
That would be fun.
I'm going to get in trouble for this one.
Try
I'm going to have to edit
night,
this out
we'll
right
see.
Here.
Let's do this thing every night for a week.
Yeah.
And then we'll test it out.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll report back.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of Peter's Podcast Live with Mona Anand. Join me for an Easter yoga retreat with Ishta teacher Petra Rechbrandt, who's the author of Yin is the New Black. Between us will yin and yang, so you can renew your view on life. And we're doing it in such a cool place, in Antigua in the British Virgin Islands. If you're like me, you're sick of this winter weather. So book your trip March 29 to April 3rd. There's a link in the show notes that will bring you to all the details. Then in August, you're of course joining me, Wendy, and Ulrika for Yoga and the Art of Living Creatively in Normandy, France. This is going to be amazing, out-of-the-box kind of a retreat. Really looking forward to having you there. Find out the details about what I'm doing, including classes, workshops, and these retreats at peterfurco.com. Back to Peter's Podcast Live. So what's going on with you? What have you been thinking about?
Oh my. A lot.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've got a lot going on right now. Yeah. So I've got my mom who's just moved back.
Mm-hmm.
I have this retreat to India coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Got the Yoga Nidra training next week. So it's busy. I feel very lucky because everything that's going on, I love.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a lot going on right now. So I'm quite busy. So
right.
I'd like a time after the retreat to slow down.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'm going to France in August. So I'm going to try that sleeping French thing.
Yes.
I spoke French before, so maybe it'll just wake it up.
Just do these, put the French, you know, I guess that's where the theory is, to put a book under your head and sleep on it.
Oh,
maybe,
yeah,
that's,
yeah.
Maybe that's
what Alan does, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He just puts them on the shelf behind him. I've been thinking a bit about the silver bullet idea lately, that everyone's always looking for a silver bullet. And, you know, we hear something or we find something or somebody, some teacher says something in a class, and we like latch on to this thing
like it's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that I said in the podcast last week with Kristen Leo, like, we're the silver bullet. You know, mm-hmm. these things are not going to do it for you. Mm-hmm. You have to do the practice.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it's hard and even when it doesn't seem like it's fruitful, you just have to stick with it mm-hmm. through that hard stuff. And do you have any thoughts about that idea about, you know, like, we're such a dabbling culture,
mm-hmm.
right? I read about this in, you know, magazine this week, or it's all over Facebook now, that this quote led me to this book, and now I'm all totally into this book, mm-hmm. and, you know, so-and-so said that, and whatever. And I find it a little bit of a challenge in our modern age, because we're all so adept at researching, and mm-hmm. it's so easy. Whereas at some point in time, probably you had a teacher and you would just, that was your source of information. So you'd do what that teacher said and you'd just keep doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a question, you'd ask that teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like we're all plugging into all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's both interesting, but it's a little bit distracting from doing one's practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I also think it's based a lot on expectations, right? We expect to be in this great state all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're looking for these silver bullets, because the expectation is we're supposed to be feeling great,
mm-hmm.
right? But if we change that, but it's that expectation that's the problem, right? I mean, I feel that that's the modern expectation, that everything has to be fixed.
Right.
Right?
And we're very impatient about it.
Yeah. Instead of changing our relationship with what's going on around us, right? Is that just that constant, like, it's a real, I think one of the things that I find so interesting when I go from here back to India is if I look at the person, I'm not talking about the people that are very westernized, but if I look at the person on the street in India, they look at ease very often. It's interesting.
At ease, yeah.
Yeah. And there's less expectation around what life is supposed to give
yeah.
you. You know, you really see that. It's like the biggest change is that seeing that there's much more acceptance of this the moment,
mm-hmm.
right? And there is something, you know, good about the desire here that things can change, right? There's always two sides to everything,
right.
you know? So that
you're looking for a balance.
Yeah, yeah. Right, between that, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
and I mean, even that the caste system source of that you're not going to change
yeah.
your position would lend to that being okay with what, I mean, you're okay with what is because
yeah.
that's what is. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
Right? And here, there's so much value placed on improving, growing, gaining. I mean, even the whole economy, it's like the idea is that it must continue to grow.
Yes, exactly.
And how is that possible? I don't know, right?
Yeah, and winning.
Yeah.
Win, 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 right?
Right,
the
and
idea,
to never,
yeah.
you know, keep getting better and better
yeah.
and better and never have aging.
Yeah.
Never have cycles of life that are
yeah.
in any way other than going to the peak.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think that we, you know, on a external level, we have so much, right, in the developed world and, you know, in the U.S. and stuff. But yet that what is acceptable has gotten so small, right? That box of what is acceptable.
Yeah, the way that we define those successes.
Yeah, even in a yoga class, right? We don't want someone's mat too close to us. We want the temperature, the music. It's like mm-hmm. so much that has to be right for our practice to be right, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like expanding the box. If we could expand our box of what is okay, right? Like the more, we're just bothered by so much,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's really kind of, it's again, why we think that we're supposed to be in this, the belief that we're supposed to, if we just get our ducks right, we'll be in nirvana.
Right.
So that's the underlying belief of the silver bullet, right?
Right.
That if you just do it all right,
yeah.
you could be there.
Right.
But if that fundamental belief was like, you know, well, things go up and things go down and that's just life.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that I think is so hard for people to get that the things are going to continue to be up and down, and mm-hmm. they're going to continue to be hard sometimes and fun sometimes, because life by its nature is this constant change. Mm-hmm. But the way that we relate to it is something that can evolve.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So our ability to deal with the ups and the downs, and that sometimes things are sad and sometimes things are joyful.
Yeah.
We get better at being okay with that.
Yeah.
And being in an even keel.
Exactly, right? Like we get more, that's what changes, right, with our practice, is that we become okay about things not being okay.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But sometimes we accidentally give people this belief that if they just do their yoga correctly, they'll be in bliss. And mm-hmm. I think that's where the mistake happens, mm-hmm. because we talk about yoga union and being in nirvana, and then when that doesn't happen, it gives people that something's wrong with my practice.
Right.
But your practice is just practicing to be able to deal with what life offers
right.
up.
And also the yeah. effects of the yoga practice is also like your life, the
yes.
whole life,
yeah.
right? Like
yeah.
you start and you're utterly miserable, and then you do some practice and then you start to feel more calm around
yeah.
things, but there's still a lot. And then just as you go and grow and grow,
yeah.
and to me that's one of the joys of having gotten older, is that yeah. I don't feel so attached to certain kinds of change happening.
Yeah.
Like I've let go that certain things are going to be different from how they are. And
yeah.
it's very freeing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think
I'm much older than you, so.
No, you're not. I think for me, what's really changed with yoga is that all of my like assumptions that I make, I find it very exciting to see all my habits rather than upsetting,
mm.
right? So mm. it's a kind of
you
like...
You amuse yourself.
Yeah. Not
well,
maybe not anyone
me
else,
all the time.
But I'm amusing myself, right? Like I find that it's easier to see all the crazy things that I do without
yeah, yeah.
minding them.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of get excited to see that yeah, crazy assumption has been guiding how
right.
I've been moving through life. Wow.
Right.
You know, like it's just really, yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, when you first start practicing, you know, you have a lot of, people tend to get a lot of rules of doing it right.
Right.
Right? And I think that, you know, what does it mean to be a yogi? Right? And I have to eat certain food
right.
and, you know, all the rest. You know, we just create these boxes.
Right.
So I feel like it's...
Like shoulds.
Yeah.
As opposed to all those things could be good if they're like the right thing for your practice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right. So I feel like being free of the label of the yogi is fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that I'm supposed to behave a certain way and do certain things and mm-hmm. think certain things. But
mm-hmm.
to find, you know, I always say that my yoga practice helped me lower my bar.
Yeah.
Right? Be more forgiving of all of
yes.
my patterns.
Yeah, that's a better way to say it. For marketing purposes.
Which,
rather than lowering my bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, more forgiving and more understanding and more realistic, right? About and not only that, it's like more clear about what life is.
Yeah.
Right? That's maybe the best marketing phrase
okay,
right there.
Okay.
More clear about what
okay.
life really is.
Yes. No, that's true. You know, I think for me with Yoga Nidra, with everything I'm interested in, I'm really, I think with having my dad being Indian, my mom being American, living in both places, lots of different spiritual traditions around me, I'm really interested in all the, not just the beliefs, which are obviously different and that makes you see life a certain way, but also the underlying, those little assumptions that are even more powerful in what you do,
yeah.
you know, and your experiences in life that create those assumptions.
Yeah.
And I think that's what when we're talking about like things like the silver bullet, and it's the underlying assumptions of what should be,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
that come in. And when we can see those assumptions that we have, then we are less resistant to what's happening.
Right.
Because that underlying assumptions... Yeah, just every time you let one go, you're a little freer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying a practice of, you know, when something does upset me, like when someone does something, say,
mm-hmm.
I'll really try to like almost take a step to the side of the upset, mm-hmm. you know, like in the Gita, it says the stuff that's happening isn't you, it's rajas and tamas and sattva mm-hmm. at play, right? Mm-hmm. And you're the consciousness there. So I've been trying to literally do that, you know, see this friction that's going on and step aside and say, what's really happening here? What is at play? What is it about me that's getting in friction with whatever's happening with that other person? And mm-hmm. in doing so, it's been very fruitful as a way to be able to say something different then, instead of being in a loop, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
the typical pattern yeah. of things. You know, it's like something has to change for that loop to not always happen.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to see if I can't do that
yeah.
shift,
yeah.
whether it's something in politics or in a personal relationship or with a family member who I don't get along with, something, whatever it is, I'll just try to make that shift. Mm-hmm. Can I change perspective, and then what? Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating because it's like you're saying, the patterns that have been driving you, you start to see them.
Yeah, and exactly what you're saying. It's actually having to sit with the weirdness inside of you to mm-hmm. kind of see the pattern, right? Mm-hmm. Because unless you sit with the
right.
the feelings, then otherwise you just react.
Right, right? And so. You put the blame on the other person always.
Yeah.
Which is just human nature,
yeah.
I think. That's
yeah.
rajas at work.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or tamas, and, you know, I'm never good enough, or things like that, where you withdraw from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so it's been an interesting bit.
Yeah, exactly what you're saying. That's kind of where the fun is. When I feel that discomfort and I get angry and I'm about, you know, and I'm feeling like that anger, instead it's kind of like, wow, look at that, how I've just flipped it, and now I'm mad at this person because I'm really uncomfortable about this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that used to make me upset. Like, I can't believe it got so mad. Now it's kind of like more interesting mm-hmm. to see it, you
yeah,
know, at
yeah.
play.
Did you guys know we got mad? I didn't know Mona got mad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're all people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So what else?
Wow. I don't know.
Yeah.
Should I interview you?
Okay. Why not?
Okay.
It's free form.
Okay. What should I ask you?
I don't know.
Well, I wasn't expecting to ask you questions. This is throwing me off.
Yeah, you don't have to.
Okay, I won't.
Okay. Great. So on your trip to India,
mm-hmm.
yoga-wise, what are you going to do?
So I usually do asana and meditation. I usually do a different chakra each day.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have like a chakra chat, discuss the chakra. And then
do you speak from the chakra?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then we have like mini workshops,
uh-huh.
different things. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be a restorative yoga nidra practice at night. And we have book club.
Book club?
Yeah.
Do you know what you're reading yet?
I haven't decided this
mm-hmm.
time. Yeah, but we have book club, and we have, yeah, to sort of not take the discussion of the chakras off the mat into, you know, into your experience and discussing how that applies in life. So.
I just downloaded Brené Brown's new book.
I haven't read
something
it.
Something about the wilderness.
Mm.
She calls it. Do you know her? She's like, she did a TED talk about vulnerability of play.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's a researcher, like a social worker researcher, PhD, and she's at Harvard, I think, now. But, she's talking about people coming together that, you know, we're in such a charged time,
mm-hmm.
and that the only way she sees through it, based on her research, is people have to become both strong in who they are
mm-hmm.
and willing to be utterly vulnerable
mm-hmm.
in who they are at the same time,
mm-hmm.
which to me is also a very yoga concept.
Absolutely, yeah.
to have that, the strength and the ease at the same time.
Yeah.
So that you can have a boundary, but you can also be inviting and compassionate.
Yeah.
And allow someone to be themselves, the other person to be him or herself, without you having to agree.
Yeah. I think that's always in, I think that's the hardest part about yoga, right? It's balance, right? Mm-hmm. And people are, we're all swinging, you know, and finding that balance in everything we do. It's, well, it's what's difficult, right?
Yeah. And sometimes we're in motion and we're just recovering. And sometimes it's just like teetering, and sometimes we just fall.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's all a part of yoga practice.
Mm-hmm.
Off the mat.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we practice on the mat in this sort of stylized way in asana.
Yeah.
And I like to look for the metaphor within those poses. You know, what is it that we're doing when we're acting the warrior?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Serge, who's here, did a thing on Virabhadra. Like, what is that myth?
Yeah.
You know? And it's so beautiful when you do the postures with that in mind. You see this, you know, demon emerging, and you see and targeting and you know, shooting through space toward the rescue and things like that. And those are such metaphorical ideas for what we deal with in life when it's in those hard moments, you know? How do we create something new, and how do we stay focused on the target, etc.? And balancing poses are just like so obvious, right? How do we stay balanced?
So. I know we don't actually talk enough often about what you're doing in class, about what the poses stand for, because they've all come from looking around in nature. And it's, you know, when I used to teach kids yoga, remember? Kids can, you know, really experience what the pose is about, right? We don't tend to do that enough in regular grown-up classes.
Yeah.
You know? In fact, actually, a lot of the yoga nidras I use are actually ones that I developed as a kid's yoga nidra teacher. Right, a lot of the visualizations. I had someone come up to me, a student, the other day and say, can I have, you know, my daughter's six, can she listen to your yoga nidra? And I said, you're actually listening to her yoga nidra.
That's great.
You know, being able to expand your mind. And I think that's sometimes missing, the looking at what the pose stands for in a class, right? We get so serious about not knowing what just the pose, without what the essence of it is.
Right. It's good to take it out of that competitive place as well.
Yeah.
I mean, some people are more kinesthetic, so they love being in that place.
Yes, right?
But for others, I think it's interesting to expand.
And it's always fun to see someone suddenly get inside their body and feel the pose in a different way, you know? That's always just, you can just see it when there's suddenly that change in the practice, right? And you can step inside.
Yeah. Nice.
Patreon is the funding site for Peter's podcast. Show you value this content by becoming a patron at any level you like, from a dollar. I'll send special rewards your way. Patrons recently got a Yoga Nidra recording that I made just for them. You can even use Patreon to arrange for a genius consultation with me, or to get a mantra targeted at your goals or challenges. Check it out today at patreon.com/peterspodcast. That's patreon.com/peterspodcast. It's the right thing to do. Enjoy the rest of our interview.
Should we let these guys ask some questions?
Yeah, sure.
Does anybody have a question?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Serge.
Can you hear?
Yeah.
So, as an Indian, did you grow up in India or lived there?
I was actually born in New York, so I'm a New Yorker. I moved to India when I was two, and then I came back at 16. And then, so I really feel like I'm both. You know, I feel completely Indian and completely American, you know, and I go back 2 or 3 times a year. Yeah. So, and I've always been fascinated by that. So it's cross-cultural psychology was what I was interested in college, this idea of why we think the way we think. And, you know, that on a macro level, now it's on a micro level in yoga, but that idea of your beliefs and your perspective has always been something that just from my experience in life has been so interesting to look at. You know?
It's your dharma.
Yeah, so I'm fascinated by just looking at different cultures and looking at different beliefs. And so much of Yoga Nidra is actually digging up your old beliefs and your old assumptions and trying to see what is clogging your ability to see what's in front of you, right?
And when you're doing that in Yoga Nidra, is there a conscious aspect to it? Like, are you noticing that later? In other words, does it become a kind of a tool psychologically?
Yes, I feel like I'm always conscious of it now. I'm always conscious of I find it fascinating to when I'm walking around even to notice the images that are going across. It's just so amazing to see the images that go across the screen of our minds, right? They're so random sometimes, they have no purpose. So I feel like I'm very conscious of it all the time. You know, it's something that just fascinates me. So it's always on my radar, you know?
Yeah. Serge, did you want to follow up?
Yeah. Considering your background, why did you instead of finding some kind of like Indian guru, you started following some South African Jewish guy from California?
You know, I like that question. I think
with all due respect. Yeah.
You know, I really like what Al stands for. He doesn't, you know, there wasn't this kind of guru-like behavior, right? There was, when you walk into Ishta, the thing about Al is that it's not like he's giving you this prescription of how to behave. It wasn't like a serious studio. He's light, and it's really about getting rid of your box, not creating a new box, right? So that was what was very freeing. When you talk to Al about anything, he meets you with what you're talking about. He doesn't come from a yogic perspective or any perspective. It's really what he genuinely thinks you need at that moment. And so to me it was freeing because he's funny and light, but yet so amazingly wise. And it was not the set of, I think I can never fit into any box, right? I don't agree with everything Al says or anyone. I've never met anyone I agree with everything they say, right? But that's what I like, not agreeing with everything everyone says, to figure out what I agree with, yeah? And that changes, right? So Ishta allows you that. You don't have to buy the whole thing. You can just take what resonates with you. And that's what, you know, is so different about it than any other system of yoga.
Yeah.
You know?
There are a lot of rules in traditional yoga.
Yes, it's very tied to Hinduism.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like I was in a workshop recently, and you know, we were lying one way versus the other way so that our feet weren't toward.
Your feet can't point towards.
And you know, I appreciated the idea, but I thought, well, my feet are pretty nice, you know.
Yeah.
And is it really true that there's a deity who doesn't like my feet?
Yeah.
Seems like a kind
there can
of
be
a
rigidity
far-fetched
in it.
Kind
yeah.
of thing. Yeah,
yeah, there's a lot of rigidity in a lot of different yoga practices, right? Mm-hmm. Rigidity, there's rigidity in every spiritual tradition, and
right.
I think that...
The orthodoxy of it.
Yeah,
yeah. And it, you know, provides a structure for sure.
Yeah.
But what I like about Ishta is that it's like pushing away the stuff that's the least important in terms of getting to the result.
Mm-hmm.
Like which way you lie in Shavasana is not going to be as impactful you know, whether or not you can do alternate nostril breathing properly. You know?
Exactly.
So let's focus on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that all of that, all those, like when you're given a set of beliefs, it creates a container of safety, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's what we use beliefs for, but mm-hmm. it's like being able to be free of them.
Right.
You know.
And at a certain point, you know, the subtlest practices, they can all have an impact.
Yeah.
But largely it's psychological, and then maybe there's some little energetic something or other going on.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth sort of prioritizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Mark.
It's a twofold for each one of you.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because if you think about each one of us being a drop mm-hmm. in the ocean, and then the dynamic from when you are born until when you die, you change throughout that period. There's such a difference between each one of us, even if we're in the same period of life. So I'm very interested in knowing about when Mona was teaching kids yoga, what do they get out of it as opposed to when you're an adult? What do they, and also Peter teaches men's yoga. So the difference between men and women and how that, what it's like teaching the difference, because a lot of times just in a regular class, there seems to be more of a female energy mm-hmm. in the room. And sort of see what that difference is and what they seem to get out of it. So this way
you can start.
So you want to know the difference between what kids get out of yoga and an adult class?
When you're a kid, there can be something vitally important to you. And as you get older, it's like, really? That's what's important to you? you've got to get a Pokemon, whatever. I mean, I'm just using that as an example. So what do they seem to get out of it when they're younger, as opposed to when you're older and you have more of maybe an agenda, you're actively going to it?
You've just got different things when you're older that you're holding on to. You know, it's, you've got a different Pokemon, right? Yeah, you know. That's the thing. We think that, you know, I think one of the things that is interesting with kids is they don't know how to relax, you know. If you tell a child to lie down, they'll lie like that, right? So I would have to come up with ways to teach them to relax, like, you know, think you're like an uncooked spaghetti or something, and then, you know, you're being boiled, and then you then, you know, feel like what a cooked spaghetti would be like. But the idea being is I would teach them how to deeply relax and also use their power of visualization to be able to take them, you know, right now we're losing our ability to visualize with all the computer games and all these things that are going on, right? And yet visualization is the most important thing. It allows you to see a different way. It allows you to not get stuck in life, right? And children have this amazing imagination. So what I taught, you know, in doing the poses, you could talk about what animal, and they could actually be that animal, right? And it's allowing them to go a little bit into fantasy and to visualize, which is so important, keeping that visual muscle. So I would take them on magic carpet rides all over the world, exploring things, you know, peeking in people's windows, friends, you know. But it just, you know, and actually what I discovered was after doing that with my daughter, with Katrina, I could never get her to fall asleep at night. But we know that what goes across the screen of your mind affects the energy in your body. Your body believes that's what's happening, right? So if I could get her out of whatever she was stressed out about by taking her on these magic carpet rides and all over and laugh and visit all these places, she would then fall asleep, right? So it's a great tool to give children an ability to be able to use their imagination to step out of whatever they're worried about, to learn that you can use your inner world and take yourself, put visuals to change the way you're feeling. Right? So that, to me, was quite amazing. And then that's what I started doing with adults, taking them on these journeys, right, and teaching us how to be able to use that skill of our imagination to be able to get out of whatever we're stuck in, you know, and to help us see where we want to go. Yeah? Does that answer it, sort of?
So they were able to get to the same point that adults do in terms of being more chill or being able to really relax?
You can teach children how to be relaxed. You can teach children how to be with their feelings. That's really important, allowing them to sit and be with their feelings, to be in their bodies, right? Because your feelings are, sensation is the first experience of feeling. So teaching children how to be in their bodies is a great way. just in that kinesthetic connection to themselves, and then their imagination using that. So to me, those were just very important tools for kids to learn, and learning how to relax, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
You've spoken a lot about the inner world.
Yeah.
Can you state the question so that people can hear?
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm asking?
Not exactly.
So you know a lot of people get into yoga and it's all about asana.
Yeah.
Beginning, but it's actually much deeper
than that. Yeah. Oh, so how did... Oh, when I came, when I came to start doing yoga as an adult, I was all into, because I'd been a gymnast, I was all into the gymnastics of it, let me tell you. I remember it was amazing to get back into doing all these crazy, like, you know, I don't know what I was doing, but chin balances and all this stuff. And I remember looking at the teachers here and thinking, God, after all these years, this is all they can do. Little did I know how little I'd be doing, right? I had this very, I would only take classes that were level 2-3 or like were hard enough, right? I was very into the, but I also started practicing yoga, and that's why it's like there's so many doors to come in through, that not ridiculing any door, whatever door is a great door. For me, I came in because I was having these massive asthma attacks and I was really, really not well. And in India, yoga is used therapeutically all the time. People are always saying, do yoga if you have asthma. So, I mean, I had been doing yoga nidra in school, started coming in to take classes. I kind of needed that aggressive, crazy yoga also, and restorative to let go of all the fear. I was like that with all the asthma medication. I was on so much cortisone, I couldn't breathe. But I also needed to burn it out. So that's what I actually needed then, you know? And then my practice started changing as I continued to practice. As you practice more, you can feel more into the subtle layers of yourself, right? At first, it's just like the big muscles, and you feel the littler muscles, and you can feel more energetically inside, yeah?
When did that happen in your own practice?
I don't know exactly when that shift happened, but I remember it being this beautiful moment when I was no longer in my head ordering my body, but when I was in my body. It was just delicious, you know? And it's what I keep wanting to help people do, because, you know, as soon as you step into your body, really, when you're inhabiting your body, then your mind stills, and it's just that peaceful feeling. And you can see it when someone has that shift in class, suddenly, where they're really inside themselves. So once I started doing that, my practice started slowing down. I was more interested in feeling inside than what gymnastic-y move I could create, you know. Then I had a few nice gifted shoulder injuries that slowed me down also. So I kept injuring the same shoulder over and over till I actually learned the lesson of doing best chaturangas. But it took many lessons to learn that lesson. And then just as I've continued, I found that I'm more and more interested in, you know, just really combining, like, how can I take a class and have it sort of relate to every kosha, not just one. Like, there's the, of course, they all interrelate, but, like, that it has the asana, but there's visualization, there's pranayama in it, there's, you know, everything in it, right? To work at the whole individual rather than just one aspect.
I think that's pretty much the answer to Mark's second question too about men versus women. Everybody's in a different place, you know, where everybody's just an individual. And, you know, I think men come culturally from an achievement place, but I think women do too. And so men who see yoga who don't know better think they can't do it for those, you know, like flexibility kind of reasons. And so they're having to let that go. But I've many times watched a couple come into class, like a man and a woman come into class and been utterly confused about who brought who, or which one likes the asana part and which one likes the meditation part. It just seems very random to me. It's not like it's a tendency, you know? And, you know, stepping outside of those gender roles, who knows? I mean, I think it's just really a matter of, you know, where are you in your own evolution? How comfortable are you in your skin? And, you know, what does it seem like we're doing, you know? So.
Yeah, and each one, a different part of the practice is easier. For some people, it's just easier. They can just go right into meditation. And some people, that's really, really difficult. And, you know, some people can just lie, walk into class and lie on a bolster. And some people lying in a restorative pose is just hell, you know? Right. So it's just, again, that's Isha, it's that individualized, like really meeting people where they are. And there isn't one route of first, you know, we generally see asana is usually easier for people, but not always,
right.
You know, you don't, yeah, it's based on what.
Yeah, I'm a little fuzzy now on my own history because I started both those practices at the same time, almost.
Yeah.
Like I remember getting interested in Yogananda.
Yeah.
And one of my neighbors was going to the Self-Realization Fellowship, and I think I went then, and then later found the asana practice.
Yeah.
So I was doing meditation when I found asana. So that was an interesting different path and then a lot of people I end up teaching these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think the same thing. Like, I was doing yoga nidra, but then I was doing aggressive asana, but then I was including yoga nidra in it, but I was really into restorative. So it just, you know, it seemed to be extremes.
Yeah.
That I was...
But I was getting something out of both of them.
Yeah, for each thing. I mean, yeah, it just seemed to be, everyone's, you know, door is interesting as to which door they come through, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any other questions? Scott.
As in love as in one person or love as in?
Love as in relationship, like being married.
Okay, I do actually very much so. I think that we tend to expect too much of one person. And, you know, we want this one person to be everything, your confidant, your best friend, this, that. There's so much expectation that nobody can live up to that expectation, that you have to spread around. You know, like you have friends that you talk to about certain things, a certain that they really can get what you're talking about. There's the person that you're in love with or in a relationship with that you get certain things from. That it's just not putting so much weight on this one person, you know. That's oh. I missed that part. I just got it.
I think that's a very good point. And also, I think the primary thing one has to do is get really comfortable with oneself. And when you do, you attract people who are similarly comfortable with themselves. And then you value each other. You know. And then I have a mantra for that, too.
See, I mean... I'm very interested in this concept because, you know, a lot of people have arranged marriages in India,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then, they, of course, are love marriages. And why do these arranged marriages work, right? And then it's got to be, comes down to expectation, right? You haven't put so many eggs in this basket, right? You're just not expecting this person to be so everything, you know? And I think that, because I see these arranged marriages, like, that just seem to, and I don't agree with arranged marriage. It's not something for me, but I see people who have them who are...
Well, it's not something for you because you're married.
Huh? Well, that
no,
too, but people often ask me if I had an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because I've got every religion in me. So, like, my... father's Hindu, my mother's Catholic, and my husband was raised Muslim. So I've got it all.
Right.
The furthest from an arranged marriage. But I'm quite fascinated by how well they can work and why. And it's because I think of this whole underlying thing of expectation of what we expect in relationship, whether it's our relationship with our parents, our children, our friends, like that underlying expectation, right?
Yeah.
It's again that assumption.
Right. Well, it's a little bit of that you leave out the having to find it, and you're just given what is, and
yeah.
then you just
yeah.
have what is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, being light of hearted about it too, I think is useful.
I'd like to hear a whole talk on this.
A whole talk on this. Sounds good.
But again, it's a perfectionism, right? That having to be perfect, or the other person's got to be perfect and do
right.
everything right for you.
Right, right. Yeah. For you. I think
for
that's
you.
That now we're overlapping, right? It's like you have to be okay yourself.
Yeah.
And then that
yeah.
other person yeah. works out.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Well, man, that's an excellent, juicy place to leave it, I think. So, thank you, Mona.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, everybody, for coming and being part of Peter's podcast live.
Thank you for having me.
Namaste.
Namaste.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Mona. I sure had a good time doing it and answering questions. You know, you can ask questions of the podcast. There's a link in the show notes for it. And just write a question. There's a blog post that says, I got a question, ask it. So if you have a question, ask it, and I'll try to cover it on the podcast. If you're a Cappuccino Q&A member on Patreon, your questions go right to the top of the list, so I'm certain to answer that question. All right? So lots of good stuff. Check out on peterfurco.com about retreats, one coming up in Antigua, one this summer in France. My class schedule is on peterfurco.com as well. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you, hearing you, getting questions from you. Check it out. I'll check you out. We'll check each other out. Awesome. Namaste.